Peninsula was a time when religious tolerance, sophisticated scholarship, glorious architecture, and a superior lifestyle prevailed. Muslim Spain is now best known by the glories of its architecture, such as the Alhambra Palace in Granada, one of Europe's most visited monuments. But it was perhaps the Cordoba Caliphate from the 8th to 11th centuries which personified Al-Andalus at its height, with Muslims, Jews, and Christians all intermingling and flourishing under Muslim rule. By the 15th century, the Christians had begun to squeeze the Muslims. But the real impetus for the fall of Granada was when Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile married to unite the two largest Christian kingdoms. These monarchs had a vision of a uniquely Catholic nation. Around 100,000 Muslims were subsequently killed or enslaved, and 200,000 fled. Later, a decree would be ordered, forcing those who remained to convert to Christianity on pain of death. The Catholic monarchs also passed a decree expelling all Jews or forcing them to convert, again on pain of death.
Well, later on in the show, we'll be talking to two experts on Islamic Spain. But first, joining us in the studio today is Roshan Mohamed Saleh, who is the editor of the Muslim news website Five Pillars. Roshan is a very frequent visitor to the historic Muslim areas of modern-day Spain and has kindly agreed to share his experiences with us today. Roshan, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on, as always. Just tell me, what's your view of Islamic Spain? Tell me about your experiences there.
Well, I've been there about 10 times over the years, and the last time was only about a month and a half ago. And I just think it's the most beautiful part of Europe. I think, and especially if you're a Muslim and you're interested in Islamic history, like every Muslim should be, then Andalusia in the southern part of Spain, where the Muslim influence is the strongest, is the place to go. And I could recommend a few places, like Granada is the obvious place with the Alhambra Palace, which is probably the most beautiful monument in Europe. It's just an amazing place, a fortress and several palaces. Then there's the Mesquita or the mosque, the Grand Mosque of Cordoba, which is literally one of the most beautiful mosques in the whole world. And even Masjid al-Nabawi in Medina, it's modelled on the Mesquita in Cordoba, the famous arches. And there are other, you know, beautiful places like there's a fortress in Malaga, there's a Muslim tower in Seville. So it's literally, and the landscape will remind lots of Muslims of North Africa as well, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, you know, mountainous olive trees everywhere. It's just a really beautiful place.
No, I'm pretty embarrassed to say I haven't been yet, unfortunately.
Okay,
I must go. But interesting enough, you've written about the sadness you feel when you visit this region as well. Could you explain that to me?
Yeah, so it's kind of, I always have mixed feelings because I'm really happy to be there. But when you visit some of these Muslim monuments, you know, they've been desecrated by the Christians. After the fall of Granada in 1492, the Catholic monarchs in particular, they had this policy of desecrating Qurans and just generally denigrating Muslim culture. So
forced
the Alhambra...
forced conversions.
Yeah, exactly. And the Alhambra, for example, they built a kind of a palace, a Christian-style palace right in the middle of the Alhambra, which looks really incongruous next to the Muslim architecture. They did the same thing in the Grand Mosque of Cordoba. They put a Christian cathedral right in the middle of that mosque. So they basically vandalized it. And, you know, when you go to these places, you can't pray, for example, if you try to pray as a Muslim, even though there's a mihrab there, you know, direction of the prayer, you know, you're ready to pray, but they won't let you pray. They'll physically stop you from praying. You could get arrested if you pray. So it's just a reminder of what we lost. And the fact is that we're not allowed to celebrate it properly in modern day Muslim Spain.
Yes, it's interesting you mention those points because there surely are some Muslims still left in Spain. What's the community like there?
Limited. There's a bit of immigration, kind of like, you know, menial labour from places like Morocco especially, but, you know, Tunisia and other places in North Africa and, you know, sub-Saharan Africa as well. But the Muslim presence in Spain is less than it would be in other European countries like the UK, for example, where we have 4 million plus Muslims, France, where there's 6 million plus Muslims. It's much less. I think it's well under a million in Spain. And that's because there's been a deliberate policy of, you know, kind of keeping the Muslim presence in Spain quite small. Mosques, for example, regularly are denied building permits. There are a few mosques now, but there aren't many mosques. But still, you can see the vestiges of Muslim Spain, even in the faces of the people, because lots of Spaniards, Christian Spaniards, were originally Arabs, and they have Arab blood in them. Even the Spanish language has lots of Arabic words. The food, and it permeates every aspect of life, but sometimes you have to look for it.
Yes, and I know that there are still place names which originate from the Arabic language.
Absolutely.
That haven't changed, that type of thing. And I wonder, very briefly, Roshan, Islamophobia is a European-wide phenomena. It's a problem across the board. But in Spain, would you say that it's worse because of this issue? They're trying to stamp out Muslim culture?
Absolutely. They were doing that because, you know, the policy once 1492 happened, it was eradication of Islam. And that has served as a blueprint for modern societies. France is going down that route in many ways. Not physical extermination, but extermination of a religion. And lots of European societies. So even the influence of, you know, the Spanish Inquisition, for example, it permeates into modern life even today.
Well, Roshan, we are going to come back to you later on in the show, if I'm not mistaken. But for the time being, I want to move on and take a look at what people on social media have been saying about the anniversary of Al-Andalus and its fall in modern-day Spain.
Twitter has become awash with opinions regarding the legacy of Islamic Spain. Muslims hold Al-Andalus in high regard and praise the period as a shining example of an Islamic region leading in tolerance and enlightenment.
One of the most understudied pieces of human history, the impact this caliphate had on knowledge building alone is tremendous to today's modern society. May this serve as a reminder for all, regardless of religion or culture, to appreciate Muslim contributions to history. Alhamdulillah, since its arrival, Islam has still been there longer than it hasn't. May bring back the Nur that illuminated Europe, and by extension, the world. Ameen.
Some non-Muslims use the occasion to troll Muslims and praise the collapse of Islamic rule in the Iberian Peninsula.
People of Spain are so happy they drove the invaders back to where they belonged. Spain grew to be a great nation and an empire. They helped greatly to push back the Ottomans and keep them away from total defeat of Europe.
While other Muslims believe lessons should be learned about Muslims and their trust for the un-Islamic world.
It's what happens when you sit on your laurels and you're not alerted to the plots of the disbelievers. You have to never trust the disbelievers and must be permanently on high alert to defend yourself and spread your cause. Today, again, we are trusting them whilst they plot our destruction. Many of the traits for which modern US prides itself comes from Muslim Spain, who achieved these traits first. Diplomacy, free trade, open borders, techniques of academic research, anthropology, fashion, algorithms, medicine, hospitals, etc. But the only thing the West associates us with is terrorism.
Well, I'm honoured to declare that we have another guest joining us now to add to this discussion. Dr. Uthman Latif, a celebrated Muslim author, a renowned historian, teacher and lecturer based here in Britain. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Now, firstly, just start off by telling us why you think Islamic Spain was so great in your view.
I think for a few reasons. One, because Spain is recognised as Al-Andalus. In fact, that period is called by historians as a convivencia, as the coexistence between Muslims, Jews and Christians, an unparalleled kind of moment in human history where Jews, Christians and Muslims could thrive under Islamic rule in Islamic Spain. So we have, of course, a great kind of legacy of achievement under great rulers like Abdurrahman III, Al-Hakam II, the building of schools, of universities, of hospitals, of mosques, of makatib, of all of these things. But I think that that period, in fact, is very unique in human history because it represents kind of like you might call a golden age of civilization in Islam, but also, in fact, in Judaism. It's also seen as a golden age of Judaism. So, even for Christians, it's seen as a very great moment in their history.
Now, one of the aspects praised by both Muslim and even non-Muslim historians as well was the overall theme of tolerance, particularly towards religious minorities under Muslim rule, like Jews, for example, and the Christians too. But was it really as harmonious as it's made out by some?
Well, society, in fact, is in constant flux. There's never going to be a totality of anything. You're going to find good moments and also difficult moments as well. But remember, of course, when the Muslims arrived in 711, the Jews were facing a lot of persecution from the Catholic Christians. You had the Fourth Council of Toledo, and Jews were forced into baptism, forced conversions, expulsion from the land. And Zion Zohar, a Jewish academic, says that when the Muslims crossed the Straits of Gibraltar, they welcome Muslims as liberators from Christian persecution. And that's kind of a standard narrative, and in fact, not just to do with Spain, but also in Jerusalem and also elsewhere as well. The Maghreb after the Inquisition as well, that Muslims always been kind of seen as champions of justice, you know, for other people. So therefore, Spain kind of, I think, is representative of that.
Now, during this period, Europe is often referred to as going through a dark age in its history. Muslim Spain, of course, was going through a period of enlightenment. What kind of role did Muslim Spain have on Dark Age Europe?
We have a kind of a juxtaposition, in fact, in historical terms and cultural social terms, because what the Muslims are doing, in fact, in Spain at that time of that darkness in European history is enlightening the world. We have the beginning, in fact, of or the seeds of the Renaissance of Western Europe. Because Spain, of course, is in Europe. And we have, like I mentioned, the thriving of the culture of arts, of science, of botany. Seville, in fact, was known as a center of botany. Abu Bakr al-Ubaidi, Ibn al-Awwam al-Ishbili, very famous names, al-Ghafiqi, Ibn al-Baytar, Ibn Zuhr, Ibn Zawar, you know, very famous names, people excelling, in fact, in sciences, in geology, in geography, in mathematics, in astronomy. And then, of course, you have the beginning of taking these knowledges back to Europe, like from people like Petrus Alfonsi, for example, Michael Scott, who learned with the Muslims in Al-Andalus, in the schools of Toledo of Cordoba, and then took that knowledge back to Western Europe and began to educate the Europeans and their nobility about what the Muslims are learning, in fact, of these great sciences. And then, of course, they took it back, they enhanced it. That became the beginning of their renaissance in Western Europe.
Now, Doctor, final question. What can we, the Muslim Ummah, learn? What lessons can we take from this period in Islamic history?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is you have this Imam Ar-Rundi writes a poem after the fall of Seville, 1248, I think it was. And it begins his poem by saying, لِكُلِّ شَيْنِ ذَا مَتَمَ نُقْصَانْ فَلَا تَغُرُّ بِالطَيْبِ الْعَيْشِ يَا إِنسَانْ فَأَيْنَ الْمُلُوكُ ذُوِ التِّيجَانِ مِنْ يَمَنٍ وَأَيْنَ مَا حَزُ قَارُونَ مِنْ ذَهَبٍ وَأَيْنَ عَدْ وَثَمُودٍ. He's asking, like, he says, everything that reaches its apex, its pinnacle, will have a defect and a fault. Nothing is, the dunya, the world we live in, isn't supposed to, in fact, to be perfect. And he says that, where are the kingdoms of Ad and Thamud? Where is Qarun and his treasures? Where is Qurtuba? He says, upon all of them came an affair. فَكَأَنَّ الْقَوْمَ مَا كَنُوا. And it's as if, and death came to all of them. And it's as if they didn't exist there in the first place. And that's a lesson, in fact. Every rule is temporal, is limited by vulnerability, by time. And so no one holds the keys of power forever. It's a lesson, in fact. I was in one of the trips I had to Spain. We visited the other city that was built outside Cordoba called the Medina of Zahra. Built after, it was named after the wife, I think, of Abdurrahman III. And 10% of it is excavated in the land from 1910 onward. That was the most glorious city. In fact, his diplomat was Jewish, Hasta ibn Shafud, and he would invite other kings and nobles to London to spend of Islamic Spain. But the city is simply a loss, is a sign for us. And so I think that you look at two or three fundamental things. One, of course, is that having too much of the world isn't always a good thing. The dunya, and they had too much of the world. And all these examples in the Quran about the positive and negative kingdoms, like, for example, Suleiman was a good king, Dhul Qarnayn, a good king, but Qarun and Fir'aun were bad kings. And about the way that they appreciate and approach temporal power. The second thing, of course, is the difficulty of division. Once you divide, you become weak. Allah in the Quran, of course, is reminding the people, don't differ and argue, because when you're divided, and that's weakness. And that's what happens. So dunya, one thing, vision, of course, is the other thing. And both of these, I think, affected the Muslims of Al-Andalus.
Unfortunately, Doctor, I have to end our discussion there for the time being. But thank you very much. We did appear to have some signal issues towards the end, but you passed on your points very, very well. And I think we learned a lot from that discussion. Well, earlier on, we also spoke to Muslim historian Asim Akil, who's also known as Tariq Trekker on YouTube. Tariq Trekker has filmed and presented an online history of Al-Andalus, which is available for all to see on his YouTube channel. We spoke about what happened to Muslim Spain after its tragic end.
I think the phenomenon of Islamic Spain known as Al-Andalus is great for many reasons. Number one, it can represent kind of like a lost paradise. It was a place where, or the first place in Europe where three religions lived together in peace for centuries, way before what we have in Europe today. I can remember listening to one historian on the topic say that the three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the people of these religions all had the same culture, which when you think about it, is very different to what we see today in the Western world. So it was very unique. Spain is a modern day conception which comes into being after 1492. Prior to that, it was the Iberian Peninsula with a whole mix of ethnicities who would come in, whether it be Goths or Vandals or Greeks or Latin people, and eventually Berbers and Arabs. And the idea that it was a conquest, you can argue that it was a conquest. There are certain narratives as well that the Muslims were actually invited in by Count Julian, a Christian ruler from Ceuta, which is in North Africa. I think the time period of the Reconquista narrative finishes in 1492. That's when the reconquest is complete. The Jewish people, unfortunately, didn't flee. They were actually thrown out. The Muslims had a bit of a leeway for a bit longer, maybe for about another 120 years, but their life was made very difficult. Under the terms of the capitulations, the Treaty of Granada, the ruler, Muhammad XII, agreed to transfer power to to Ferdinand and Isabella on the premise that the Muslim population could keep their religion, keep their properties, and keep their wealth. Within 10 years, there'd been a lot of aggravation by the Catholic authorities to the Muslims in the Granada region, so they rebelled. Ferdinand and Isabella claimed that this rebellion was in violation of the Treaty of Granada, so they did not show any more religious tolerance towards the Muslims. So they were then ordered to force to convert to Catholicism en masse, which the vast majority of people did. They kept Islam in their hearts, and they practiced Islam in secret in their houses, and outwardly, in public, they appeared as Christian. But the authorities were aware of what was going on, and slowly but surely, they started clamping down. So they started banning all Arabic books, burning the Quran, banning Arabic dress, banning Arabic customs, asking people to keep their doors open, their houses on Friday, so they could come in and see what you were doing. And on days which would have been Eid as well. And as the decades went on, towards the end of the 1560s and the 1570s, the way which these rules were enforced became a lot more stricter, until eventually Muslims decided to go all out rebellion. We're going to declare our Islam openly, and we're going to fight for our existence. This was brutally put down. And eventually the order came in the early 1600s that all Moriscos, and a Morisco is a Spanish word which means little more, i.e. person who used to be Muslim, probably still is a Muslim, but Christian outwardly, has to be expelled from the Iberian Peninsula. So by 1613, the remaining Muslims were on the coast, ready to get ships to North Africa.
So a sad and brutal end to Islamic Spain there. But let's head back to my guest in the studio, Roshan Mohamed Saleh, for more on this. So, Roshan, of course, we've learned a lot today about Islamic Spain, and there's many positives that we take from that period, and potentially some not so many positives as well, as we saw from the brutal way it ended. But tell me, do you think that Al-Andalus could serve as a model for a future Islamic society?
I think it's certainly a model for Muslims in Europe because of the nature of the... I mean, it was a Muslim society. It was Muslim ruled. Muslims were in charge. It was God-centered. But at the same time, minorities thrived. Christians and Jews especially thrived within that society. And I think given that in Europe and even parts of the Muslim world, We have countries which may be Muslim majority, but there are lots of minorities there as well of other religions. It does serve as a model. It serves as a model of, you know, kind of, it's a reminder of what we could achieve when we were at our best. And I do believe wholeheartedly it can be implemented today as well. And the other thing I wanted to say is that I think this whole show has been a reminder for us that Muslims, we must study our glorious Islamic history. I mean, there were several golden ages. I guess Sunnis would say the Rashidun period was the golden age. I know Shias might have a different conception of that. Then there was the golden age under the Abbasids in Baghdad. And I think the third and perhaps the last golden age of Islamic history was Muslim Spain. The Ottomans may disagree with that, you know, but there's arguments to and fro. But I think, you know, it serves as a real iman booster for Muslims to study our history. And it wasn't all a bed of roses. We had bad kings and good kings, good rulers, bad rulers, good periods and bad periods. You know, history is human, and Islamic history is human as well. But what I always say is the bad bits come from the humans, the good bits come from Islam.
Do you think that that's a problem, though, Roshan, that perhaps we're over-glorifying these periods when, of course, you know, like you say, they weren't perfect, they weren't a utopian society?
I think we should study Islamic history in depth, not just Muslim Spain, but the Ottoman period, the Arab period, all the different periods, even Muslims as minorities in the West. And we'll find good and bad. But I sincerely believe that the good far outweighs the bad. But we shouldn't sugarcoat our history as well. We don't have to defend every aspect of history in Muslim countries, like slavery, for example. There's a lot of bad stuff that went on there. But that's not from Islam. It's from flawed human beings. And the final thing I want to say is that, you know, may the light of Islam shine in the Iberian Peninsula, in modern-day Spain and Portugal, yet again today.
Inshallah. Well, that might be an interesting question to end the show on as well. What should we be doing? Because, as you say, you're not allowed to go there and pray, for example. There's a bit of desecration going on. Like, I don't know, should Muslims do more about this? Should there be some kind of effort done to try and change the Spanish authorities' view on this? What do you think?
I think we need to raise awareness about, you know, how we're treated. I mean, I went to the mosque in Cordoba just about a month and a half ago. I did a little video saying, you know, the Christians have desecrated this place. And this is what we've lost. It's a reminder of what we've lost.
Do you think we should just go there and start praying regardless?
Well, people have done that. I mean, you'll get arrested. So, you know, I'm not encouraging people to get arrested, but Muslims have done that, and they have been arrested. And some of them, I think, been threatened with deportation or prison or something like that.
Wow.
I don't think anyone has been jailed, but,
ridiculous.
You know, they don't allow. They have security guards running around. I just think we have to raise awareness. And, of course, as Muslims, we have to give dawah. We have to invite the Spanish non-Muslims to Islam. This is what we have to do, you know, as Muslims. It's part of our duty.
It's fascinating how the emphasis is on pointing the finger at how Islam behaves and how Muslims behave, apparently spreading by the sword, when in fact we see here with the Reconquista that actually Christianity was spread by the sword in this regard. Thank you, Roshan. We have to end it there. We could talk a lot more on this. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today. But thank you to all of our guests and for you at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant practice.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. The second condition after wish of heart in order to be nurtured divinely is having knowledge. As soon as I wish in heart to be nurtured in my spirituality, I must try hard to gain knowledge in this regard. Spiritual wayfaring is exactly like physical exercise. We must be under the tutelage of a trainer, because the trainer has the knowledge. He knows how to help us. Now, the best trainer of our soul is Imam al-Mahdi. We are under his watch every moment and minute of our lives.
خدا نکنه اسم ما رو خط بزنه بگه این دیگه آدم باشه بگی نیست.
God forbid if Imam al-Mahdi loses hope in nurturing us, we won't be able to restart our spiritual journey. This is what Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam told about Abu Muslim al-Khurasani. Abu Muslim wanted to serve Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam and wrote a letter to him. However, the Imam didn't accept his request, because Abu Muslim did not act based on the exact teachings of the Imam of his time, Imam al-Mahdi. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Since the beginning of Russia's special operation in Ukraine a year ago, Western countries, particularly United States of America and Britain, have prolonged the war in Ukraine with their military support for Kiev. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia's Itatas news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Russian President Vladimir Putin said supplies of weapons to Ukraine by NATO bloc may be considered the participation in conflict, since the alliance received no payments for it, which means the West becomes a companion in Kiev's crimes. President Putin stated in an interview on Russia One television channel, aired on Sunday, 26th of February, President Putin said, "They supply arms worth tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine. This is participation in the war. But why? Because it is not simply military technical cooperation, since they do not receive any money for it." He added that those arms are delivered unilaterally, which means in a way, at least indirectly, but still, it means participating in the war in Ukraine. Commenting on suspension of Russia's participation in the New START treaty, President Putin stated that Russia should take into account the nuclear potential of not only the United States, but all other NATO countries as well, as the alliance considers Moscow's strategic defeat as its key goal. He stressed, "Amid today's conditions, as all leading NATO countries have announced our strategic defeat as their key goal for making our people suffer, as they put it, how cannot we consider their nuclear potential amid this environment?" The Russian president said the West has only one goal of liquidating the Russian Federation. He added, "They have one goal of liquidating the former Soviet Union and its main part, the Russian Federation." President Putin stressed that the world should change, though Moscow is against building the new world in the interests of only one country, the United States. He said, "Regardless of the talk that Russia is the legal successor of the former Soviet Union, in the legal sense, it is true. Though we are not speaking about legal sentences, but about the potential. Today's Russia has different potential. We understand it, and we agree that the world should change." President Putin added, "Moscow is never against such changes, including in the United Nations, thinking about reforming the UN. But what are we against? Against building the new world order only in the interests of one country, that is, the United States." The Izvestia Daily has also covered this story and tells us more. Former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has warned that the continued influx of Western weaponry into Ukraine amid the raging war will only prolong the war and may lead to a nuclear catastrophe. In his remarks published on Monday, 27th of February, Dmitry Medvedev, a key aide to President Vladimir Putin and deputy chairman of the Security Council of the Russian Federation, urged an immediate halt to Western military supplies to Kiev. The Russian official reiterated his threat of nuclear war over Ukraine if Western countries continue to arm Ukraine despite repeated warnings from Moscow. Dmitry Medvedev said, "Of course, the pumping of more weaponry can continue and prevent any possibility of reviving negotiations. Our enemies are doing just that, not wanting to understand that their goal was certainly will lead to a total fiasco, loss for everyone, a collapse, an apocalypse, where you forget for centuries about your former life until the rubble ceases to emit radiation." The latest comments by Dmitry Medvedev follow President Vladimir Putin's recent nuclear warning and his Sunday, 26th of February remarks casting Moscow's confrontation with the West as an existential battle for the survival of the Russian state and the Russian people. Since Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine a year ago, the United States and its European allies have provided billions of dollars worth of military aid to Ukraine, despite repeated warnings from the Kremlin that such military aid will only prolong the war. U.S. President Joe Biden, in his speech on Tuesday, 21st of February, said the United States and its allies will not get tired of backing Ukraine, in a sign that the NATO military alliance is not willing to take a step backwards. The U.S. has been Ukraine's strongest military partner since the start of the war in February of last year, providing Kiev with more weaponry and equipment than all other countries put together. In a list released by the White House on 20th of February, Washington's total military assistance to Ukraine has reached about $29.8 billion since the start of the war. The Biden administration marked the first anniversary of Russia's military operation in Ukraine on 24th of February by announcing new military aid to Ukraine and sanctions against Russia. In an article published in the National Defense Magazine recently, as quoted by Itatas news agency, Dmitry Medvedev said, Russia is again confronted with an empire of diverse enemies 80 years after the victory of the Battle of Stalingrad. He wrote, history repeats itself. We're again confronted, actually, with a whole empire of diverse enemies. Ukrainian and European neo-Nazis, the United States of America, other Anglo-Saxons and their minions. President Putin on Sunday accused the NATO military alliance of taking part in the Ukraine war by giving weaponry to Kiev, and hastened to add that the West plans to break up Russia.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij, Bahth al-Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahth al-Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, trying to help me with the answers to the questions related to the rules of purification based on the fatwas by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, how could a person or an individual who's always doubtful about the validity of one's wudu or their wudu, you know, we know that there are people who get doubtful, who become doubtful of their own acts. Whenever it comes to wudu, they are doubtful whether, for example, they did the mass or not, or when it comes to the prayer, for example, sometimes they think that they miss a rak'ah, for example, right, a unit of the prayer. So how could these people go about their, wudu and when they go to masjid, pray, read the Noble Quran, visit the shrine of the infallibles, alayhi wassalam?
Well, basically, no attention should be paid to the doubt concerning the state of purity after one is sure that he has performed wudu. And it's very much important for a believer who wants to perform prayers or any other religious acts which require wudu to give the benefit of the doubt to himself and always consider himself to be in the state of purity when he is certain that he has made wudu and that he was in the state of purity. Because there is a principle or a rule which says, which we call istishab, and that means presume the continuity of the previous condition, the previous state. So when we are certain that I'm, for example, certain that I did make wudu, but then now I doubt whether I'm still in the state of wudu or not, or whether I have done something and that my wudu might have become invalid. Then in such a state, when I'm not certain, I should give the benefit of the doubt to myself and I should consider myself as being still in the state of ritual purity.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, this kind of obsession, we should fight it We should fight it. The scholars, the religious authorities have always said that we should not, you should not be so much particular. You should not be obsessive or very much scrupulous mm-hmm. when it comes to being in the state of ritual purity, or even when you are someone who doubts very frequently, very often. And he should not pay heed to his doubt, and he should go ahead acting and doing what is to his benefit. And this is the scenario where one has to pay no attention to his doubt, and he should consider himself in the state of ritual purity because he knows that he was in the state of wuzu. And so therefore, performing prayers, reading the Holy Quran, and of course, doing any other amal or acts of religious obligations yeah. or devotion, which require wudu, should be without any problem.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back to our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions. Allah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, Ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of purification according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, Sheikh Javed, we all know that we also learned it from our elders. Like when we make wudu, there is always this condition that we are told, like to do the wiping or mass from the elbow downwards to the fingers after pouring or when pouring some water over the elbow, right?
Yeah.
So is this condition necessary, it's sufficient to, have the hands like rolled over and wiped with a wet hand, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, if the water is sufficient enough, then it's necessary to pour water and make it flow off the fingertip or from wherever it falls off. Okay, but in the event that there is little water, it is sufficient to make the water reach all parts of the skin, and because there is not sufficient water, it's not possible to make the water flow off. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is sufficient water.
It doesn't flow over all areas of the skin.
But what is actually important is to start washing the hands or soaking your hands from the elbow to the tip, and making sure that the all parts of your forearms actually become wet. You know, starting from the elbow to the tip.
Yes.
In the event that there's not sufficient water, but if there is water, of course, you have to pour water. And pouring water means that you have to start washing your hand from your elbow, washing your arms from the elbow to the tip. And in that case, of course, the water will definitely flow off.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, now a quite relevant question a near question to the point that we were just discussing lately is that in wiping the head,
yes.
Is it sufficient to make the hair wet, or is it obligatory that the moisture from the hand reaches the skin of the head or the scalp as well?
Okay. Of course, the answer given by His Eminence is that, of course, one can do the wiping of the head on the upper part of the scalp or the hair, of course, depending on whether the hair is thick, long or mm-hmm. not. Of course, if the hair is collected on the upper part of the head, and then it's not enough. His Eminence says that it's not enough to pass wet hand on it. Okay, rather one must part the hair to do mass on the upper part of the scalp, because you need to make sure that your fingers, your wet fingers, actually touch the scalp, you know, and or actually the root of the hair, you know, we can call it the base of the hair, because it's necessary to make sure that you either wipe the part near the base or the root of the hair or the scalp, and in the event that the hair is collected or it's very much thick or long, then that means you need to part it into two and pull your finger or your palm in between and that very portion which is divided, the middle point.
But if the hair is medium size, then yes, there is no need actually for doing the parting.
There's no need. Yeah, you can just pull down or up, you know. And of course, it's always permissible to wipe from top to bottom or from bottom to top.
Mm-hmm.
And either way, wiping is allowed and permissible.
How about the artificial hair? If somebody's wearing wigs, how should they go about their wiping or mass, doing the mass?
Well, we know that wigs are not allowed when performing wudu or performing ghusl, as long as it constitutes or forms a barrier. Especially when wiping the front part of the head, if the wigs are there, then you cannot make wudu with the wigs. And His Eminence says that, of course, if the hair is implanted, it is permissible, you know.
Because it's part of your natural hair now.
Yeah, it is part of your hair. And of course, it's never possible to remove it because it's implanted.
Yes.
And it is, you know, it is real. It's not synthetic or artificial. So you can wipe on it. But in the event that it is, you know, synthetic or artificial, and of course, it's not natural in any way, then it should be removed, provided that it does not, constitute or involve mm-hmm. unbearable or undue hardship.
Right.
Hardship.
Okay.
And in that case, if it is, you know, His Eminence says that if removing the artificial hair, probably it is glued to the scalp,
mm-hmm.
or it is kind of impossible to remove it.
Yes.
Then in that case, His Eminence says that wiping on that hair is sufficient.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.